Hi, I'm Ralf Schumacher, and you're listening to Beyond the Grid.
Hi all, and welcome to Beyond the Grid, presented by the new Bose noise-cancelling headphones 700. My name's Tom Clarkson, and I'm joined this week by a driver who on his day was a match for anyone. He drove for Jordan, Williams and Toyota in an F1 career that spanned 11 years, and he's also got a very familiar surname. I'm talking, of course, about Ralf Schumacher. Ralf won 6 races during his Grand Prix career, and anyone who saw him drive in his first season, in 1997, might tell you that 6 was a poor return for his ability. After all, he finished on the podium in only his 3rd Grand Prix for Jordan. But Ralf found himself in the right teams at the wrong time. And he also raced in an era when brother Michael was enjoying unprecedented success with Ferrari. A few years away from the F1 paddock has mellowed Ralf somewhat, and he's also become a racing dad in recent years because his son David is now in Formula 3. We caught up at the Russian Grand Prix last month, and it was good to see Ralf again. He looked fit and relaxed, and what he had to say was very interesting. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Ralf, great to see you. Lovely to have you on the show. Damn it. You're looking really well. I don't think you've put 1 kilo on since you retired.
I don't know, maybe.
Now look, what do I don't even know what I call you these days. Are you a team principal? Are you a driver manager, racing dad, all of the above?
Well, it's a combination, I'd say. I mean, obviously, since I have the karting team, the Formula 4 and the Formula Regional, this new class, which is in between the Formula 3 International and the old one. Yes, I'm a team principal and enjoying working with young talents and their parents, which sometimes is the biggest job, especially in karting in Formula 4. Apart from that, certainly David takes a big part of my life now with supporting him and looking after him, plus some Sky, Germany.
I'm really interested that you're doing all of this karting and US racing and things. What was the motivation? Is it you giving something back to the sport?
Well, the motivation, honestly, is if my whole life was motorsport and racing, and saying that I was, I stopped Formula 1, and for me it was always clear not being one of those guys being in a paddock, walking around doing nothing. So I just didn't want to come anymore and just enjoyed my life, but enjoyed as well my time with David. And doing that, I did my own karting team, it started off, and then I came across, you know, after DTM with Gerhard Unger. And there we were, and it's called US because of us, Gerhard and myself, and not US, by the way. Okay. And by the way, US is Unger Schumacher. So that's how the name came in, because it's always difficult to find a name. Yeah, that's how it all went so far. Then we had this new Formula Regional theme, and we saw the race here, and I believe it. And that's when we said, okay, we do that as well.
How are you as a racing dad? Do you get nervous?
In the beginning, I would say, karting, you know, there's a lot of races happening. And I have to say, if you want to enjoy motorsport, you should watch a kart race sometimes, because that's very similar to motorcycle, you know, overtaking until the last corner and really fighting and hard racing. So it's really nice to do that. And at that time, I think, yes, you can call me racing dad and being quite hard with what I expect and how to move on. The first car race, I remember, it was a bit of a different situation. You're kind of nervous as a dad, you know, that something can happen or everything goes right the way you'd expected. And after you know, relax more and more.
Do you enjoy it?
Well, I enjoy being at races and I enjoy seeing the progress, and sometimes obviously there's not only progress, there's some hard bits about it as well. But the great thing, whatever will happen in the future, is to spend so much time with your kid. I think nobody can give you that back, and the relation you have, it's really strong and really nice.
And tell us a little bit about David. How old is he now?
We'd turn 18 end of October.
What kind of kid is he? Is he like his dad?
No, luckily not. No, he's nicer than I am, or than I ever was, I have to say. He's a very nice person, I have to say. He, funny enough, I mean, if he goes through the paddock, I mean, you know me in my times, I'd never like to give interviews and stuff like that. It wasn't a part of my life to satisfy the media. And for him, it goes more easy. You know, he's doing that quite well. And the driving bit as well. I have to say he's very calm as a person. And on the other hand, very focused. So it's quite, in the moment, I'm very happy with the way everything develops.
I find it really interesting. And I look at you, I look at Jos Verstappen as well, and it seems you're both breeding the next generation, and you've almost, like Jos in particular says very openly, I've learned from my mistakes as a driver and made sure that Max hasn't made those. Are you sort of giving a lot of your experience as well to David?
Well, certainly you try, and certainly you try, especially the things that you know that you did wrong and where you didn't push enough and stuff like that. And you certainly try. But then, you know, the older they get, they have known character, and it does sometimes it's not so easy enough to understand and learn and make their own mistakes as well. So you can, you know, you can give some, let's say, advice, and sometimes maybe a little harder on advices. But on the other hand, it's their own character, own life, so they have to go their own way sometimes.
We're chatting in Russia at the Sochi Grand Prix, and I met David very briefly yesterday. English is impeccable. How many languages does he speak?
Well, he's only German and English because he was too lazy to learn French. He did it in school, but it just, you know, to pass it, which is a shame because actually he could. And I guess his English is not too bad because his girlfriend speaks English too. So I guess that's why.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, Ralph, let's talk a little bit about your career now. Can you remember the first time you drove a Formula One car? It was a McLaren at Silverstone 1996. Can you remember what impression the car made on you?
I have to say, at that time, I was driving Formula Nippon, and it was just great to come into that company, to make this seat, and to Dave Ryan was at that time in charge of this with the other guy. Who was it called?
Was it Indy Lal?
Yeah.
The test team manager. Yeah.
And that was it was really nice to work with them. And I have to say, then I went out, and I mean, the car was impressive. The power was impressive, I would say, but not so much the cornering speed, funny enough. But at that time, the Formula Nippon had ground effect cars in Japan with qualifying tires, and especially Suzuka, we were quite fast. So it was a great day that I remember. We did something like more than 110 laps. First day was against David. Second, it was Mika.
You were the Formula Nippon champion in 96. Just out of interest, your sort of qualifying time at Suzuka, would that have put you comfortably on the Formula One grid?
I think we were 3 seconds off. At that time, the spread in the field was much bigger. Yes, I think 3.2 something off the pole position, yeah.
I do remember it being, I mean, you got up to speed very quickly in Formula One and were so impressive in that first year with Jordan as well.
We were lucky. I have to say this, not lucky. Gary Anderson happened to build an amazing car in 97. The only problem was it was young drivers, Giancarlo, myself, and a team that was pretty young. Because when we did the first test in that car in Jerez, we couldn't believe how fast it was. Nobody expected it. And so we were afraid to take the fuel out because we were really faster than Williams was. And Williams was the team to beat at that time. So anyway, first time we took the fuel out was in qualifying in Melbourne. So we never worked on the car on low fuel, low balance, nothing. And then the two young drivers, myself and Giancarlo and myself, we couldn't do it. The grip wasn't there and it didn't work. Then we went to Argentina, as you might remember. It was then the race after, I think it was the second race at that time, I don't know. And it was completely stupid because we could have won it.
I know.
And yeah, but it was, if you look at it after, you know, Jordan was strong enough the year after to take a team decision on Damon and myself. And if at that time Giancarlo was simply slow at that race at that moment, could have changed after, you know, but it was so stupid because we would have won easily by 10, because I finished second, I think, with the crash and extra pit stop, 19, 20 seconds behind Jack in that car, and it would have won easily the race, which was a shame.
But Ralph, for people who can't remember, so you and Fizzy collided in that race.
Yes, yeah, we did.
DJ say to you afterwards?
No, nobody said anything. I mean, obviously, there was a bit, but at the end of the day, it was a clear mistake by the team not to handle the situation properly. Because, you know, if you have, what do you expect from two 20-year-old drivers? They want to win. And the biggest shame about it was, you know, then obviously after team started to develop and Jordan was too small, so we did not use the best out of that car.
God, Alfred, even now I'm sensing a bit of frustration looking back at that race.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it took me ages after to win a race, and there was a possibility. And Jordan, and it always proved to be a great team, even after Eddie, I have to say, was always a very small, compact group of people that, with smaller budget, achieved always a good result. And it's a shame for the team, I have to say. And in hindsight, I have to, if you look at Eddie, he's a great guy, you know, he can always laugh, although I have more than 3 million reasons to be angry about something that happened afterwards, but no, I can't with him. But he had this talent to find young, motivated people, put them in the right positions and make them work.
Certainly did that. What about the relationship with Fisichella in that first season?
There was none, really, you know, after that anyway. And I was not the person to have good relationship with my teammates anyway. So
just too competitive.
Too competitive. And for me, I don't know. I mean, a teammate can never be a friend. So all you expect from him is to work together and to reach the goal with the car, with the team, and after you fight against him. So that's what I expect from a teammate, not more, not less. And I wouldn't spend dinner with a teammate. I never did.
But Ralph, I find it you're not alone in thinking that, all these drivers I speak to. And I sort of wonder sometimes whether, did you enjoy the journey, or was it just so competitive that do you look back and think, well, perhaps Fizzy and I could have got on because we're quite similar, or is it just the nature of the business?
It's the nature of the business, I would say, but it's I mean, the only guy that I spoke to, even in my career, after we worked together, I said, okay, it's a shame, actually, that was Juan Pablo, because, you know, he's quite a cool guy, but obviously in the team, he tried to beat me, I tried to beat him, and he tried everything politically, whatever. It was the time. But after all, I have to say, he's a good guy, and we could have had more fun together. But, you know, at that time, you're young, everybody has his manager, and then I really like what Frank does and did and achieved, but Frank is that kind of guy. He likes to have fight in between his drivers because he thinks by doing that, he will get the best out of the drivers. And this is a very old mentality and old way of working. And he just basically, you know, he was not helping the situation.
Frank Williams.
Yes. Right.
We'll get back to Ralph in just a minute after this short message. If one thing is constant in this fast-paced world, it's change. And if you're anything like me, then all too often you might find yourself jumping from screen to screen, getting lost in your phone, checking messages, schedules, and to-do lists, and missing out on the action all around us. Well, the brand new Bose noise-cancelling headphones 700 can help you do all of that and keep your head up to the world with easy access to voice assistance. So you can easily take a phone call on the go with the most powerful microphone system for voice pickup, even in busy and noisy environments. I've certainly found myself in a few of those during this F1 season. The new design is available in black or silver, and it incorporates intuitive touch controls, so you can easily change the volume of your latest playlist, phone calls, or the latest episode of Beyond the Grid. In fact, Bose's world-renowned and adaptable noise-cancelling technology could allow you to immerse yourself in multiple episodes of Beyond the Grid across 20 hours of battery life. And it doesn't stop there. Oh no! These headphones also include Bose AR, a first-of-its-kind audio augmented reality platform that makes astonishing new audio experiences possible. So make sure your head's up, hands-free, and your ears amazed with the brand new Bose noise-cancelling headphones 700. But for now, let's get our heads back into the chat with Ralph. Before we move on from Jordan, I think you've alluded to it, but Spa 98. That 98 season, first of all, Damon comes in. Did you welcome him? Were you excited about having did you see him as a sort of decent benchmark for yourself?
What should I say? I mean, for me, there was nothing to lose, was only to gain. But Damon didn't take me serious in the beginning.
What do you mean?
well, I mean, he was coming from Williams, and he thought, you know, okay, there's somebody easy to handle and to beat, and it didn't work out for him at the end, but it doesn't matter. He got a lot of support from the team, obviously, coming from Williams, and he deserved at the time. But he was a rather difficult character as well. But then he was a lot older than I was, you know, more experienced and trying to be clever and maybe being taught by all those, I don't know, more experienced driver, how to politically work against your teammate. But this is a thing. Maybe that's why I am like I am, and especially as a teammate, I couldn't care less. I didn't care, you know, at all.
Did that all come to a head at Spa? Is that what you mean, all the political games? And then when you start, you're one and two, and...
I mean, okay, the team had to take the decision. And I understand as a team owner, I would do the same today. But the problem was Damon wanted desperately to win that race. And what he said on the radio is, I'm going to win that race. If Ralph tries to pass me, I'm going to crash into him, because we rather lose both, but I'm not going to lose against Ralph. That was his saying. And then Eddie took the decision.
Did you feel you were quicker on the day?
I was a lot quicker, but I couldn't, you know, obviously he was weaving, and then Eddie was afraid. So he said to me, okay, Ralph, please don't overtake. And, you know, for me, it was always clear that I didn't like the decision, but it was a decision by the team owner. And, you know, I had to follow it. And I did.
Was that the moment where you thought, I need to move on?
No.
Or was the Williams deal already in the bag at that point?
No. That was completely different. But I have to say, you know, the problem was the 98 car, as good as the 97 was, as you know, that 98 car was really, really bad. It was so far away from everything, and it was so difficult to handle. And we were lucky at that moment. But before that, and I think it was before that, the first point we scored in Silverstone.
It was late, wasn't it? I remember it being very late, yeah.
Yeah, and what at that time happened, because we had a qualifying and an engine failing qualifying. So, obviously I was last. And at that time, you needed to have P7 in order to get to score a point. And EJ came to the grid and said to me, Ralph, just one thing, if you don't score a point this race, you are out next year.
Talk about motivating your drivers. Yes.
I said, okay.
Did he really say that on the grid?
He said that on the grid, yeah. And so I called Willie and said, okay, you know, one thing is clear. Whatever is going to happen, I'm not going to drive next year for this guy, because, you know, this is not fair, and there's no behavior, because not my mistake to build this car, not my mistake to have an engine failure. So I don't want to drive for him anymore. So that was the mission. That was the decision when I decided not to drive for Jordan anymore.
And was Williams the obvious choice? Did you know about BMW coming in at that point?
I mean, Frank was interested, so he approached us actually at the same weekend. And it only happened because Frank was impressed because I scored the point. And what happened after the race, EJ came and said, no, forget about what I said, and you're a star, blah, 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 how he is, you know. And I said, yeah, thanks very much. And on the way home, I got a call from Willie, because Frank called him and asking for the year after. So we flew there. Did I stay there or did I go there the next day? I can't remember. Signed a letter of intent, and then it was clear that I was going to drive for Williams.
So it was that clear for you that was the right thing for your career?
I think it was the best option at the time, and nobody would have said that Williams were going to struggle. And I think we achieved the time 2000, 2001. I mean, we had some successful years. The only problem was the working relationship between England and Germany didn't work out and I think that was the major problem. Otherwise, we could have won world championships again in that team.
Why didn't that relationship work between BMW and Williams?
Yeah. What should I say? I know it's my point of view, and I can only see my point of view. I think Frank and Patrick overestimated the possibilities, capacities, and chances to run the team in the right direction. I think they should have used BMW more. They were prepared to spend a lot of money to help the team even more, but they refused it.
Do you mean let BMW buy into the team?
It was not about buying in. Maybe they would have done eventually because they bought Sauber, you know. But at that time, both of them were so stubborn, it was unbelievable. So it's just, you know, they didn't listen at all. And we had clear, obvious problems. And there was a lot of, let's say, possibilities to fix those problems. A lot of support was given and was offered. But they didn't want it. So at the end, it was a decision to leave because of no, you know, the results didn't come and nobody wanted to help.
But technically, you had the best engine for a couple of seasons. Is that fair to say?
I would say sometimes we had more than 60, 70 horsepower advantage, yeah.
And so even if there are issues between team and engine partner, do you still have to pinch yourself now that with that kind of advantage, Williams couldn't translate that advantage into a
I have to say we could have won a championship. Which year was it when I had the two accidents in a row? Was it 2004?
You had...
Monza because the rear suspension collapsed?
Monza was 2003. That crash was 2003. And then you went and missed a race, didn't you? And then 2004, you missed six races.
Yeah, but that was the same year. Wasn't it the same year when we had the two crashes? I don't know. It was the same year. Wasn't it? Anyway, we really had the chance. The car was there. And then the rear left suspension broke in Lesmo 1. And I just had, you know, just had that accident and concussion and everything. So I couldn't race. Otherwise, that year we could have done it, I'm sure, because the car, the package was there. And ever after, it became more and more difficult. We had some gearbox issues. The rear end was too heavy. Aerodynamics, remember this ugly nose we had, you know, that all those things. It was really difficult. And help was there, but they didn't want it.
How frustrating.
Well, after all, it was very frustrating because to me that after that, obviously having a chance to get a top team was impossible. Then there was only Toyota and Sauber I could have gone to.
I was going
to
say, could you have gone with BMW to Sauber?
Yeah, but I would have needed... I mean, the problem was at that time, they made a contract with Sauber and that was a year in between. And there was something very privately happening with Frank and myself, and I decided that I couldn't stay there anymore, and that's why, you know, I didn't want to wait a year, and that's why I signed with Toyota.
Well, look, let's look at some of the highlights, because there were still highlights. Frustrating that you didn't win the title, but, you know, I want to ask you about a couple of races. You know, that first win comes at Imola in 2001, having been so close on several occasions before. What was the overriding emotion, do you remember? Was it relief? Was it just elation?
I mean, it was a special day because in the morning, my engine guy tried to start the engine without pressurizing the valves. So they had to take off the engine and take everything apart because otherwise I would have gone backwards on the grid, you know, when we had to change it anyway. So they did it within 2.5 hours. The complete engine wasn't pieces, everything, every valve, everything was in pieces. I was really surprised. Put it together and we won the race. What should I say? I remember Bernie giving me that silver plated thing and he said it was about time for you. And I said, yes, sorry, it took a bit long. I know, but that was about it. And I have to say, there was I think 1 week or even 2 weeks later was the next race. Was it? No, I don't know where it was. And Formula One, I mean, yes, you can be happy about what you achieve, but then I was always that guy thinking about the next race. So, you know, I could enjoy it for a little moment, but I was, you know, once you're there and you achieved it, you want to go on. And then, you know, it's a strange thing, but it happened. So, but it was a nice moment for sure.
You were damn good at Imola. You were really good at Imola every year, I remember. What was it about that track?
I don't know. I think it's...
But would you agree with that?
Maybe. I don't remember everything about that. It's just, I mean, there's depends on the driving style, obviously. I was always quite late on brakes, so I felt more difficult to drive tracks where you had like long corners. But saying that, I was not slow in Maniku either. So, but it's, you know, there were tracks you like and tracks you don't like. And maybe Imola was one of the better ones for me.
It definitely was. It's no secret that the greatest Formula One drivers in the world can make the most difficult race look easy. But what really happened on track? Well, Amazon Web Services has the answer. F1 uses machine learning and predictive modeling built by AWS to create critical race performance statistics, make race predictions, and give fans insight into the split-second decisions made by teams and drivers. Now F1 can pinpoint how a driver is performing and share these insights over television and digital platforms all over the world. With AWS, you can rely on the Pit Strategy Battle function to show you the predicted gap between drivers after pit stops, as it analyzes how successful each driver's strategy will, or perhaps won't, be. It's all to play for. While the Battle Forecast function lets you delve into the developing driver battles during the race, heightening the racing experience for you, the fans, and it's all powered by AWS's incredible machine learning and data analytics. So should Hamilton have made that second pit stop in Japan? And what were his chances of overtaking Vettel in the closing laps? And what about Leclerc's charge through the field? It was all there for you at the Japanese Grand Prix. So next time you're watching your favorite F1 driver and wondering how they get all those awesome insights, just remember, AWS is how. Find out more at aws.com/F1insights. That's aws.com/F1insights. Now let's get back to the interview. You touched on JPM, Juan Pablo Montoya. From the outside, I always felt there was a bit of friction between you two, but you're saying, was that incorrect?
No, it was, but only in the year or the, in the time where we worked together, it was. But I think it's him himself. He was as well. He was a bit surprised by the speed I had, I guess. Because when he came, you know, everybody rated him as the next world champion. I know. And okay, I think we, at the end of the day, you know, we were at a similar level. Because I read an interview, he made some comments about me at that time, and you know, so he tried to do everything with internally to make me nervous. Or he was a kind of political guy, but I understand, you know, he wanted to go on. So,
because I think there was the perception in the paddock that he was a Williams guy, you were a BM guy. Is that
fair? Right?
And sort of because of all the issues between those two parties that we've already talked about. There was, as a result,
because of the obvious issue, because I wanted to become world champion. I saw the chance in that Williams had, and I saw the problems on the Williams side as much as sometimes there were some problems on the BMW side, but at least they were open about it. Williams never had a problem, and they had a lot of problems, you know, but Frank didn't want to talk about it.
And did you see it as your job as the driver to get involved in non-driving matters?
It became my job because there was, it was so difficult between the two parties to have a proper conversation and to just get on with the job. Sometimes it was really difficult, I have to say. And well, you could do it Juan Pablo way, you know, don't give a shit, just drive. But I wanted, my plan was different and long term, but it didn't work out at the end.
So let's talk teammates then, but we'll come on to Toyota. So your teammates, Fisichella, Damon Hill, Alex Zanardi, we haven't met, but Jenson Button, that first year at Williams, yeah. Montoya, truly. Who was the fastest of that lot?
This is a difficult, I would say Juan Pablo was clearly the fastest.
Over one lap, over the race?
No, in general, because Juan Pablo was good at qualifying, mentally very strong. And, okay, sometimes he took a very high risk on overtaking, but he was quite good on that too. So, as a package, I think he was the best teammate to work with. And maybe, but I think we even did at a test. If I choose a teammate to go out for dinner, then Jensen would be the better one. Yeah.
Jensen. Well, what about Jensen as a driver too? Because he comes in 2000. It's his first year. He's 20 years old.
He was fast, but he was young at that time. He just started, and it, you know, if you start on a team, you need about 3 to 6 months. Half of this first, you know, season to be in it and to get the best out of it. For sure, he was strong too, but he was quite young.
He was that. What about the year before that? Alex Zanardi, he won everything. Well, of course, he had a Formula One career with Lotus and things. Then he goes to America and dominates there. Were you surprised that it didn't come together for him?
He couldn't handle the car. For him, it was the braking situation was a problem because he was used to steel brakes. And the car was always on the nervous side. And I mean, beside the fact that the car was really terrible.
What, the 99?
Well, the only good thing about it was the design. I mean, and then we had this engine and, well, it was just a difficult year. But it was clear when I joined the team, it was clear. And even at that time, you know, we were still full steel suspension and everything. It was, a special car. And Alex was an easy teammate, but he was a bit too far away, and that didn't help the development. And the other problem was he always wanted different things than I wanted. But luckily, because he was so much slower sometimes, that, you know, the team just followed the other route, luckily.
All right, so it comes to an end at Williams. You go to Toyota. How hopeful were you going there?
The motivation was there. It was, money was never a question there. I just remember when I signed it, I went out of the door with Willie and in front of the door, Willie wasn't sure. And I said, well, what should we do? And I said, I'm aware of the fact it works, then we continue. If it doesn't work, that's the last 3 years of Formula One.
You knew that going in?
Yeah, sure. Going out when I signed.
Were there any other options on the table at that point?
But nothing. That was the best option we had.
Right. Yeah.
And the biggest potential, because, you know, that team with all those budgets, possibilities, and Toyota as a mega manufacturer, you thought, okay. And there would have been a possibility. The only problem is a culture problem, and the way that Toyota got successful, because the way they run the company is to keep rotating positions to make sure quality is there, and everybody at any time can reproduce the same product, and not depending on one or a single or a couple of people. That doesn't work in Formula One, because, you know, you need to be continuously strong. You need the right people at the right position for a long time to just go there. And Japanese, they didn't trust the Europeans a bit. And then, you know, they were more busy writing reports than trying to work on actual things. So it was a bit of a shame, because everybody was motivated from all sides, but maybe we should have approached it a bit different.
Interesting. So they'd already been in Formula One for 3 years by the time you got there, and they still hadn't quite worked out what they needed.
Well, I think the problem was a little bit, and I understand, when they first started to work, maybe the European part of the organization wasn't at the level it should have been. And I think they just didn't understand why, you know, because they knew, or whatever they did, whenever they did it, they were successful and fast. And they didn't want to believe it as the most successful car company, that something, the most successful, that something goes not the way they expected. And I think they didn't trust Europe that much anymore. And then they wanted to get involved. I mean, you know, we spent a crazy amount of, we had an engine development in Cologne with the Italian side. And then they did a second engine in Japan just to show Cologne that they could have been better theoretically, which they weren't, but they tried, you know, so money was spent on that and things like that.
Yeah. And were you, did you try and bring anyone in from a technical point
of view? Oh, yes. I brought,
there were a few people.
I brought a few people in, but we had a technical director at the time, an English one, that for sure wasn't a very nice guy, but I think he was, maybe the operation was a bit too big for him. And since I was in very good contact to Michelin, and at the time there was a guy that I always worked at Michelin, he was in charge of the race operation for Michelin, and let's say he then took over the organization of Toyota, and I think it was all going the right way, but it was too late.
Do you know what, Ralph, it's really interesting reliving, because of course I was there as a journalist as well, but it's really interesting, just it seems your F1 career, particularly with Williams and Toyota, was, it could easily have been different, or particularly with Williams, maybe less so with Toyota, but frustrating.
But it didn't work. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, that's why I always say six Grand Prix, you know, some people, I don't think is a big achievement in 11 season of Formula One, because there was more potential. On the other hand, you see today is the same. You know, if you end up in the right team, you have a possibility. If you don't, that's it. You know, look at Nico Hülkenberg. He's doing Formula One for how long now? He wasn't even on the podium. It looks pretty much like it's his last season. And for sure, he had a big potential, but he never got a chance.
Mm. What was the happiest time of your career? Where were you happiest?
I have to say, I was always quite happy. I just didn't like the situations where life in Formula One is difficult enough. But if you start to make your life difficult internally for nothing, for no reason, then it starts to be frustrating. But then, you know, like I did my work and I think I did it quite good. I could have been more pushy sometimes and work harder, that's clear.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that at some stage, if you want to do something, then maybe you have to put a bit more effort and going into even more into details with setups and so on. At that time, we didn't have the possibility like today, but still there was enough. And maybe I did a mistake there too. Should ask my engineers. But in general, I was always able to enjoy. And even if I was really unhappy at the end of the day, I went to a nice restaurant with my friends and enjoyed the evening, because, you know, sometimes you cannot change things in life.
It's not over yet. We'll be back with Ralph after this short message about a very special offer we've got for you. If you haven't yet succumbed to growing a beard in preparation for the winter months and you want a quality shave for half the price of other brands out there, then make sure you go to harrys.com/F1podcast to get your hands on a trial set for just £3.95. There are 600 engineers, designers, craftsmen and chemists in the Harry's factory in Germany, working hard and making products with only the finest materials and ingredients to ensure that you get the smoothest shave possible. And getting your hands on a trial set couldn't be easier. Just enter your details online and you'll get a package delivered to your door with all you need to get going, including a weighted ergonomic handle, ensuring maximum comfort and grip while you shave, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade. My handle came in a vivid orange colour, but you can also choose from olive or navy. You'll also get a foaming shave gel to keep your skin looking good and a handy little travel blade cover to protect your kit. So get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support our podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including a razor handle, 5 blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/F1podcast right now. That's harrys.com/F1podcast. Right, let's get back to Ralph. Best car?
I think it was the time that 2003 and 2004 car, no, 2003, I think was quite good. Four was a bit difficult. And and I think it was a great moment when the first race in BMW, we finished third on the podium, was a great moment too with this engine at that time.
Yeah. Best race?
I don't know. I still remember that once I had a race in Manicur where we started 18th or 19th and I finished 5th or 6th with this car at that time. That was a great race, I remember. But there's no other special occasion that I could think of.
Can I ask you about Canada 01? You win the race. Michael's...
Okay.
Brother Michael's second. The only siblings to have achieved that in the history of the sport.
For us, I mean, we were pretty strong, and I just, because my son happened to show it to me not too long ago, that's why I remember. I think I stayed out longer because I couldn't overtake on track, something like that. And I overtook him in the pits.
I'm just stuck on this memory of back in the Schumacher household, you and David sitting down watching your old race wins.
No, he showed to me. I don't.
Son, sit down.
He showed to me because it was I don't know why. But one thing I have to say, they all enjoy, all the kids, what they talk about is the sound we had at the time.
Sound.
Mm. Engine sound. And actually, they're right. We did more than 20,000 at the end, RPM. And okay, it was horrible to work in that environment sometimes.
It was noisy, wasn't it?
It was noisy. Yeah,
what was it like in the car when you're at someone like Monaco going through the tunnel?
Yeah, that's okay because, that's not a
problem. Even
the biggest problem at that time was background noises or frequency for the radio. But apart from that, it wasn't a problem.
But so you and David, you sat down watching Canada 2001.
No, he showed it quickly on the mobile phone to me. I don't know why it was. But that's why I remember I overtook Michael in the pits. But we had a better car at that time and with the lower fuel. But I just couldn't. I remember that's why I saw it. I tried to overtake him a couple of times, but straight line speed, the Ferrari was a little bit better in Montreal. Although we had the much stronger engine, but aerodynamically we had like a garage door a little bit. So driving garage door. So sorry, it's the truth. Efficiency, the car was good, was well balanced, but efficiency was a problem. We happened to win the one.
Can you remember the podium? I mean,
nope.
Just being up there, I was wondering.
No, I can't. Sorry. It was, yeah.
Any cheeky comments from the younger brother?
No, not at all. I mean, no. We really fight it hard against each other in some occasions when it was possible for whatever reason. But for us, I mean, everything that Michael did, I was so happy for him and it was really amazing. And every time I was fast or had a good weekend, it was the same for him, that there was never an issue.
How intense was that rivalry?
When I was that year, when it got closer, sometimes it was a bit more difficult. That's the way it is, because at the end of the day, we were responsible for our team, partner, sponsors, and we clearly divided that. And even at dinner, we never talked about motor racing or never about the car. At the end of the season, sometimes, or in the beginning when I was at Jordan, okay, that was a different story, but cannot remember that we ever talked about details or anything. We were too competitive for that.
Well, I find that quite, as someone I've got a brother and anyone else listening who's got siblings, it's to live through such an intense period as Formula One with a sibling must be an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, but when you asked me in the beginning, the only thing I have to say is that it's really a shame because it goes so fast and week by week, and we had test race, that you miss out sometimes to enjoy or to remember things. That's why I cannot remember things. It's in 11 years.
It's a blur.
In 11 years' time, you travel around the globe so fast and, week by week. I was at home like, I think 1 year was because my ex-wife counted it, 62 days or 63 days, something like that. Okay, being a race driver, compared to a mechanic or working a team, you have a nice life. But still, just to explain the situation, you come from Malaysia, you sit after race, 11 o'clock flight, I think it was, 11:30, yeah, back to Europe.
Is. Yeah. Yeah.
5 o'clock in Frankfurt, quickly home. Monday afternoon, Jerez. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, testing, if not Friday. And if we didn't do more than 100 laps, Frank called us already. Why didn't we do 100 laps at least? So it's true.
Ralph, these guys have it so easy now. Yeah. That's what we're concluding, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't think it's good because Formula One, to me, not in each country, but struggles a little bit because Formula One, for me, every week you were hearing or seeing something of Formula One, especially if I consider just Germany, England, I know every news, even at the test, teams were there and promoting Formula One. I mean, media teams were there to promote Formula One. And we missed that a bit, in my opinion. Okay, we have more races, understand, but that's what Formula One misses to me.
Did you enjoy testing?
No. Clear no.
In a word.
When the car was new, it was fine. But just You know, when you do the second race simulation at that first test day or whatever, and test the same thing every day, it can be quite tough sometimes. And especially when you're tired, you know, you just did an overseas race, you come back with jet lag and everything. But I have to say, when I had my accident in the States and I was like 3 months off, and it was the first test in Silverstone, it was really most impressive to be back in the car. That reminded me of how nice it is to drive a Formula One car, or reminded me. Because, you know, with all the years driving, you sometimes forget the pleasure a bit. But there it was really amazing to be back in that car.
Of course, that accident you're talking about was the one that we ended up with just six cars on the grid, didn't we, in Indianapolis. That's what you're referring to?
No, that was the year before.
So we're talking about, I was talking about the US Grand Prix in 2005.
Yeah, but I hit the wall twice. Once in a Williams, once in a Toyota.
The Toyota was the one that ended up with that. That was fine.
But that was because it was a right angle and it was lucky. And I slided alongside. The bigger problem was when there was an accident at the start and there was some debris on the track. And I think we cut the tire and I got a puncture, an exploded tire in the banking, and I spun rearwards into the wall. That was the one I'm talking about. So I had to stop for 3 months.
Was it the back?
Yeah, vertebra and some other things, but yeah. So two were broken.
Do you have any lasting effects now? Or are you physically 100%?
No, it's all fine. Luckily...
Physically good.
Your physique is okay, yeah.
Yeah? Mm. Okay. Did want to ask you one question in that. Would your career have been different had Michael not been a Formula One driver?
The question is, would I have made it to Formula One if Michael wouldn't have been there? I cannot tell you. So I don't think so. I think everything, the way it went was okay. It just didn't work out. For sure, down to me sometimes, and a bit unlucky with the incidents and accidents I had.
That's interesting. If you could change one thing in your career, what would you change? Any decision or?
No decision. Decisions I wouldn't change. I think I would be in general, maybe a little more focused on what I did, and I would have been stronger on what I wanted in a team, because there was a chance and I made some mistakes. I should have had more influence on the situation before I signed the extension or the second contract with Williams.
Influence in terms of what?
Of organization and how to be able to go forward.
I want to see more integration between BMW and is that what we're talking about? Bigger picture?
Yes, that was the biggest mistake, because all four, including Juan Pablo, could have been more successful.
Mm. And so... when are we next going to see... when are we going to see David in Formula 1?
I mean, he's doing now like the first experience in Formula 3 International, and he's young. He turns 18 these days, some crazy... Anyway, doesn't matter. Don't want to get into that. But depending on how he does now, and maybe we do Macau as well, we decide what we do next year. I think he's a calm person. He has some potential, but it's very early to say. And I think, you know, from what I learned in my life, when I was in Formula 3, my target was to be strong in Formula 3. I didn't think about the next step. And that's the way we keep doing
it. And that's with him as well, you're trying?
Yes.
I've got to ask this question. Is he faster than his dad?
I hope so. Because that makes sense, you know, after only six races in Formula 1 and nothing else, it makes sense if he's better than I am.
Oh, well, it's been wonderful to chat. So, I mean, what do you think, 3 years' time?
About what?
David.
I don't know where he's in 3 years' time. First of all, he has to be good in Formula 3. And if he's good enough, maybe people see him and want him for the Formula 2.
Okay. And then we see. And have you got any ambitions outside of racing?
Not really. I mean, the life I live is great. I'm still in motorsports in the junior classes. That's what I said in the beginning. I really like that. Now I do Sky. And
do you like being a TV pundit?
Yes, but it's just funny when I do something, I want to do it right, and it's a complete different thing. And commentary, I mean, I'm not only an expert. To be an expert, it's not easy, but it's easier. You have somebody asking you a question, and okay, with the knowledge I have from my old days and listening a bit, you can handle the situation. But being 2.5 hours or 2 hours, in total it's 2.5 hours in front of that monitor and to make the comments about what's happening is a different story, completely different story. And I was afraid of doing that. And in the beginning, it was quite hard. It's now getting better and better, but I'm not happy with it yet. And to work on that is a target. And that's why I like it too. You know, it's really, it's a challenge for me.
When the light goes red and you're on camera, do you feel relaxed? Do you get a buzz out of it?
No, I feel relaxed. That's not a problem. The only thing I'm not happy with is, or not good in yet, is interviewing other drivers, because it's a position, I don't know, I don't like yet. So I don't feel comfortable, and that I can see myself. I only did two yet, once with Toto and once with
Charles Leclerc?
Yes, yesterday.
Go on, how was it? How do you find Charles Leclerc? I think German is probably the only language he can't speak.
No, he knows what he wants, and you can clearly tell, and I think he will be the future star in Ferrari, and maybe after as well. And he's doing a really good job. He's a calm, towards the outside, a calm kid, but I think very, very focused, let's call it that way, on what he wants. And a small taste we got on the radio in Singapore, I would say, of that. But he's clever enough, even in the interview, to apologize for it. And he said, I need to change the style on that. So I think we're going to enjoy him a lot in Formula One. And especially, I'd be surprised what's happening when he will have his world championship, his first one, or when he will be longer in Formula One, more mature. And it's going to be interesting.
Why do you find it difficult interviewing drivers?
I don't know.
Because you know how they think. Surely the one...
No, it's just uncomfortable to ask the questions, you know. And it's just an uncomfortable situation for me. It's not difficult. I have to get into it more, you know, more open, more and not only listening to the questions, get in there. But it's something, or to the answers, I mean, it's something that I have to get used to. That's it.
And I guess what, Kimi's the only guy still going from your era?
He's 4 years younger than I am, I think, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He is 40.
Yeah.
He might still be doing it when he's 44.
Yeah, but I have to say he's doing a good job still, you know, and why not? Chapeau.
Chapeau. Well, yeah. Look, chapeau to you. It's been wonderful to chat, Ralph. Thank you so much for your time. It's just been great to relive. I hope it hasn't, you know, I hope you've enjoyed it too.
No, it was a great experience. Normally I'd said things that I wouldn't say, but who cares? It's a long time ago, so I'm allowed to.
All right. Thanks so much. Cheers. There were lots of little gems in there that I enjoyed, although I don't think Williams and BMW will necessarily enjoy his assessment of their partnership. But what surprised me a bit is that Ralph is completely at ease with what he achieved in Formula One. He's happy with his 6 race wins. And it was also fascinating to hear what he had to say about brother Michael and the influence that Michael had on him and his career. And I'd like to take this moment, on behalf of F1 fans all over the world, to say keep fighting, Michael. Thanks for your time, Ralph. It was great to see you and great to catch up. Well, that's it for this episode, but we'll be back in just 7 sleeps with another big name from the world of F1. Until then, why not subscribe to Beyond the Grid if you haven't already? We're on all of your favourite podcast apps, including Apple and Spotify. And thanks for your feedback about last week's episode with Ralph's former teammate, Jenson Button. JB was in cracking form and you guys loved hearing from him. Excellent episode and great insights on Jensen's career, said Rahul Arora via Twitter. Nice to hear Jensen mention Lewis, Alonso and Schumacher. He's truly one of the best sportsmen F1 has seen. Couldn't agree more, Rahul. Not only was JB a great driver, he's now a great ambassador for the sport as well. And he talks with so much passion about F1. As ever, please keep your feedback coming. We love it. And remember to use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid, and you can tweet me at @TomClarksonF1. Beyond the Grid is produced by F1
in association with Audioboom. Until next time, keep it flat out.